Blog.
Everybody, welcome to another great show here we have of Suspense Radio. So happy that you can join us wherever you are or whenever you want to listen to us, whether or not you're listening to us live or you get the podcast and listening to us later. I am your host, John Robb, and we have a wonderful show for you today. Two authors, Tom Robb Smith, author of his latest book, Agent Six, which is the third and the last in his trilogy series. And then we have Susan Wingate coming up, the author of Drowning. And she's going to be joining us, and she's also the host of Blog Talk Radio Show Dialogue Between the Lines, co-hosting that with Joshua Graham. So don't move anywhere unless you're going to go now and go get something to drink, because 60 Minutes of Suspense Radio begins right now. I want to thank everybody for joining us today. It's going to be a great show, and we're going to hop right in here with our first guest of this Saturday here, January the 21st, is author Tom Robb Smith, author, like I said, of his latest book, Agent Six, the third in his trilogy, last book here in his trilogy, and we want to thank Tom for coming. So, Tom, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's nice to be on the show.
Absolutely. So like I said, let me tell everybody, too, your website is tomrobbsmith.com, so people can find out a lot more about you and more about the series if they're not, I guess, you know, if they're not familiar with it. And the series started off here with the book you had, The Secret Speech, and then you went to Child 44 first, my fault, and then The Secret Speech, and now you're coming out with Agent Six. Can you kind of tell everybody a little bit about the trilogy, you know, some of the behind the scenes, you know, your main character, things like that?
Yeah, the trilogy began with Child 44, which
right.
It really featured on the idea of Russia's first serial killer. And the reason that was interesting is because Soviet Russia denied that there could be any crime. They set up that crime was this Western idea that it only existed in decadent capitalist societies. So when there is this killer, I mean, a nonsense idea, obviously. So when there is this killer in Soviet Russia, to even admit that there was this killer was itself an act of, it was a political crime. And that, to me, was a great starting point for a story. And it's based on a real-life case, the case of Andrei Chikatilo, who murdered in the 80s. And I moved that back to the 50s because I wanted to set it at, you know, during Stalinist Russia, when it
right.
was most dangerous to say anything against the state. And that was that's the starting point for Child 44. You know, I invented then this detective, Leo Demidov, and his journey. To me, it was interesting to have a detective who, you know, he works for the secret police. So he spends his career, you know, he believes, starts off believing in the state, and he's an idealist. And a dreamer, but he's been richly rewarded for arresting innocent people, which is to say political prisoners, and he's given a big apartment, he's given all the perks of that society for doing that. And in an act of redemption in Child 44, this character decides that he's going to risk his career, risk everything, his life, everything, in order to go after this killer. And so you have the journey of someone who is richly rewarded for a detective that's richly rewarded for arresting innocent people, becoming criminalized for going after someone who is genuinely guilty. And that, to me, was a very interesting sort of reversal of a traditional crime structure.
And like you said, you're talking about Russia. You moved it from the 80s back into the 50s. But Russia's not really a country as, people my age, and, I'm 41, and we grew up, and everything was the Cold War, and, Russia was, and the United States had a lot of people don't remember this, especially if you're younger, had a huge Cold War going on that could have exploded at any time, at any place. You had no idea. And how difficult was it with a country like Russia and everything that was going on to research a book like this, because they're probably not that open and wanting to give out information, like, kind of what we are in the United States, where you can get a lot easier.
Yeah, it's a good question, because actually I think it would have been very difficult to have written the book maybe, say, 20, 30 years ago.
Right.
After the fall of communism, the archives were opened, and there's a huge amount now of research you can do in terms of, diaries were found that were just the secret police confiscates. In fact, Agent 6 opens with this story of a young girl, a 13-year-old girl, who's arrested, and Leo, the main character, is given the job of going through her diary, a 13-year-old's diary, line by line, and underlining the things that are considered anti-Soviet, or, for example, might give clues as to whether her parents say anything that is anti-Soviet. And this is based on a real this diary exists. You can buy it now. It's been published with the original Russian on one side, which even includes the secret police's annotations.
Wow.
And then on the other side you have a translation. And so, all of that stuff was released. And actually what's interesting now is that open policy, which is a very recent thing, is now suddenly being closed down again by Putin's Russia, and the degree of access is being limited, and suddenly you're feeling some of those constraints creep back in. But there was, for a big chunk of time, there was a big period of liberalization with regards to information, and it was possible to get hold of lots of it, and that's been reproduced now in the history books. There's a vast amount that you can read of not only just of interpretive stuff, but of first-hand sources. And that, I wouldn't have been able to write the book without those.
Now, the one thing that, always intrigues me, too, is, of course, from your accent, I can tell that, you're from Europe and probably from England. I'm just gonna guess on that one. So, I'm just taking a wild step. So, what I always find is that, when you're writing, and of course World War II all happened over in Europe, and, the United States was, of course, involved, and all we had, we had Pearl Harbor, but, we weren't in the cleanup and the aftermath and everything that had to go along with, Europe and everything over there. So when you're writing a story like that and it goes big over in Europe, do you find that you have a difficult barrier trying to get the readers over here in the United States to kind of grasp onto that and get it? Because while we understand in World War II and everything else, and it was, very deadly for our troops, it wasn't deadly for our citizens, and that's kind of where Europe is more passionate about that war, because, of course, it was, World War I and II were right in their backyard.
I think, I've written down, so there are three books, and they're in different periods. I think, obviously, Russia, America, in Agent 6, there's a line about them referring, and actually I was toying with this as a possible title for agencies, the adversary, because they referred to America as the main adversary. That was almost their code slang for it. And I think America really gets that rivalry. I mean, it was an ideological rivalry, and so there's that political side to it, but it was fundamentally also just a national rivalry, and it was really pivoted between those two countries. So certainly there's been no problem latching onto that. I think some of the secret speech takes place in the Hungarian, part of it is in the Hungarian Revolution, or the attempted revolution, and that, I think, it was a huge event at the time. It was of critical importance because it was a real splintering of the Soviet bloc in Europe. And I think maybe that event has dropped away from people's eyes a little. But certainly that central rivalry is I think, very... People have a real keen sense of it here in the States. And Agent 6, actually, the opening part of it concentrates on a very particular American form of adversary, which is the Soviets targeted race as a way mm-hmm. of causing fracture lines in society. They thought that by supporting certain activists, they could somehow foment a revolution. I mean, that was their big thing. How can we have a revolution in America? How can we cause that? And so they really went after race as a possible. They also went after women. They thought maybe women could be the way in. That didn't work. They went after race. That didn't work either. But during their attempts, you know, I've never come across such a cynical form of realpolitik. And they were... You know, they were trying to foment a revolution by using racial discourse, the race riots. And that, to me, was a very interesting story. And I'm not sure how well that's known, but it's certainly something that when you talk about, I think lots of people latch onto that.
Yeah, that's something that, you know, I had no idea about, you know, either. It's just, I guess, kind of when you're listening now, you're almost getting the sense that the Russian-U.S. war, I just read a story not too long ago where the Cold War could be heating back up again a little bit between Russia and the United States. And I kind of find that intriguing just because it has been over for quite some time. And the one thing, too, is that Agent 6 is the trilogy. It's the end. It's the third book in the series. So when you started with Child 44, did you know that you were only going to write three books, or did you plan on Child 44 to be a standalone and then it crept into three books? How did kind of all of that kind of evolve, you know, in your head? And did it finish the way that you thought it was going to be when you started it?
Yeah, it's interesting because when I was writing Child 4, I didn't have a book agent. I didn't have a publishing deal. It was a totally speculative novel. In fact, I was told explicitly when I mentioned it to some people that the Soviet Union, no one was interested. In a way, what you said, that question about aren't people even interested in the Cold War now? It seems like it's, you know, it's over, it's done, it's the past. I was told mm-hmm. that it was not a very commercial idea. But, you know, I really believed in the story. I thought this is an amazing way, not just because of the history, which I thought was fascinating, but
right.
because it was a totally new spin on a much-loved crime structure. And people love crime stories. And I think the crime aspect is a very easy way of getting into this story. Is it drags you in through that. I had absolutely no idea what would happen. I was writing this book, you know, in my spare time, and you know, it was not commissioned, so I had no idea, let alone that there would be a second and third. And then, you know, I didn't even envision this idea that it could be published internationally, and now it's, you know, it's been published in 35 countries. We've sold 2 million copies of it worldwide. I mean, none of these things even literally, and I'm not trying to be modest or anything, they didn't even cross my mind. I mean, I just thought, mm-hmm. I really hope someone in England will pick it up and it'll get published. I did, you know, that. So it was that was it. And I think part of it is that when you're writing a book, you're scared to dream. Obviously, you want to dream big, but you're scared because if it doesn't get published, you're heartbroken. It takes you 5 years to pick up the confidence to try again. So you're always sort of careful. And then what happened is, once it did get published, I thought, is this the right place to end this character? I mean, without giving away the ending of Child 44, it didn't feel like I'd really addressed everything that I'd set up with this character that I really love writing about, Leo, because he had done some terrible things in service of this ideology. And it felt like that had to be addressed. And I really do feel like, you know, if you read the three books, you really see him moving it through the journey of his past as well, trying to address some of the things that he's done wrong. And finally, the end point of the trilogy in Agent 6 feels like it's absolutely the right place to end that character, to bring him to that position. And I certainly couldn't imagine taking him out of that situation. So it does really feel like, you know, you've had a good arc with him in those three books.
Now, for someone who hasn't read your work and they're just finding out about you, and then they know that you have Agent 6 and they just hear that that's the third book in the trilogy, would you recommend and say, look, you know, you should really go back and read Child 44 and then The Secret Speech before you land into Agent 6, because there's things that they might understand, kind of like picking up The Return of the King in the Lord of the Rings series, and you'd be like, you know, read The Return, you know, you wouldn't read The Return of the King first to go back to read The Fellowship of the Ring. Is that kind of how your trilogy goes, or is it possible for them to kind of read them out of order and still be in the game?
No, you, I definitely think you can. You can pick your order because they're whole books in the sense that everything they contain everything you need to know to read the book. So Agent 6, for example, starts in the past. It starts when Leo meets his wife, and his wife Raissa is an absolutely vital character in all three stories. She is, in many ways, you know, lots of great detectives have companions. They have a sort of, you know, sort of the person they work with, and she is his. She's the, she is the brilliance. She's the real sort of sparkling intelligence, and he has a kind of dogged tenacity, and they're a very good combination. And in the, you know, in the first book, you really see the beginning of their relationship. I mean, the thing that unravels for him is that he thinks she loves him when in fact she married him because she was terrified of him. And it's a question of how do they, you know, how does that relationship then go from there? Can they fix it together? And you see in Agent 6 the beginning of that, the first moment they meet, and you see the way in which he's deluded in thinking that she's going out with him because, you know, she finds him appealing. She goes out with him because she's terrified of saying no to him. She's terrified that she says no to this very powerful secret police officer. Then she might then end up the next day being arrested because he's full of spite at the fact that she's rejected him. So, you know, it contained, you know, that you wouldn't have to start in Child 44 to understand the relationship because I've given you a sort of glimpse of it at the beginning of Agent 6. So I certainly think you could start with Agent 6 if you wanted to. But, you know, there are other advantages to starting at the beginning and going 1, 2, 3. You know, it's up to the reader. You can construct your experience of the story by picking them as they appear.
And I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with author Tom Rob Smith, and his website is tomrobsmith.com, and his latest book is Agent 6. Like we said, the last book in the trilogy going back with Child 44 and then The Secret Speech. So, Tom, I'm curious to kind of know, since you were picked up in England, and I'm sure now that your book has been sold into the American publishers, what's kind of the experience? Because now that you're publishing with Grand Central, you know, you're publishing with Grand Central, what is, you know, your experience has been like, I guess, from, you know, not just from, you know, different publisher, but just country to country. How is it different as far as like the marketing aspect and you know, kind of getting yourself into it, especially from when you first started with Child 44 until now Agent 6? How's that ride been?
What do you mean, just generally or specifically in the States?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a little more generally, but then, you know, some kind of specifics, the differences between, you know, what do they expect of you, like, when you're in England compared to maybe what do they expect of you when you're over in the United States. Are those kinds of differences, do they have, like, a little fundamental difference when they're talking about you having to market your books and things like that, just as an author point of view? Because publishing has all kind of changed.
Yeah, no one's given me any specific sort of, you must talk about this in the States rather than this. No one's ever said that. And I would say that, just as a sort of point of note, in interviews in not just the States, but also in Europe and in actually most other countries apart from England, they tend to be they're much more serious. Often I find English interviews are more interested in your personality. Just they're kind of lighter. They make kind of jokes and but there's a real, for example, Italians. I remember the interviews being incredibly serious and incredibly into the sort of the politics and the history. And I noticed that there's perhaps a little less of that in England. There's a little less reaction to the sort of the meat of the novels. And maybe that's just some of the interviews I had. It's hard to say. But certainly in the States, you know, I didn't really feel any sort of hostility that, you know, that I wasn't American or somehow that there was some barrier to overcome. I mean, Child 44 went straight in at number 9 on the New York Times bestseller list, and, you know, I didn't even come over and do a press tour for that. That was just from some phone interviews that I'd done, and I think right now there's a sort of, you know, a promotion going on for Child 44 in the e-books, and it was number 1 on Barnes & Noble. And so, you know, there doesn't seem to be, to me, any sort of barriers that I'm struggling to overcome here in America. I mean, I think it really helps going to the country, and I've, you know, spent a lot of time now in the States, and it's the same as true when I went to Japan. I did a load of interviews. I think it really does benefit an author to go to the country and meet the journalist face to face. I think people really like that. Readers really respond to that. I wrote an article, like, for example, Japan after the it suffered that terrible tsunami. I was set to do a reading tour there, and they were like, you know, we're not sure whether you would come to Tokyo, but, you know, tourism is down by, I think it's like something like a third. And
wow.
I was like, well, no, you know, I really want, you know, this is an amazing trip. I'm desperate to go. So I went. And again, you know, you really felt like people responded to that. So I would say, just as from an international point of view, you know, it's really good to go to the country and meet your readers face to face.
Yeah, because we're crazy in the United States, so sometimes you got to watch out for us. Because we're crazy over here. I mean, I just don't get it, you know. So
crazy about what?
No, we're just crazy people. Americans are just insane. I mean, it's just funny when you just look at some of the things that we do, and it's like some of the things that they hold. It's like, boy, we're just crazy people.
Every country has its quirks, though. I mean, look, I'm half Swedish, and like we love dancing around. I mean, during midsummer, we love dancing around these midsummer poles, you know, with flowers in our hair. I've got photos in Santa Lucia, which is this Christmas festival where, you know, it's to celebrate the darkest day, and you know, we walk around with candles in our hair, and every country has its quirks, mm-hmm. and it has its, you know, it's, and you know, more seriously, it has its political sides that can be quite, you know, surprising to other people. So, you know, I've traveled a lot, and I'm always interested in the different quirks, and I'm also quite sort of, you know, open-minded about that, really.
Well, I will say this. There's one thing that you and I have in common, and what is that? And what that is that both of us love the movie Clash of the Titans. That was one of the first movies that I fell in love with, and that was kind of my love for mythology that I started getting into and wanting to really study and whatnot. And you also have that same love of Clash of the Titans. So
how do you
I don't know.
That?
Huh?
Did I say that in an interview? Because yeah, that's true. I do love that movie.
No, I do my research, Tom. I'm just not some yokel just coming out asking questions.
I was like, I didn't ever tweet about that movie. But it's true. No, when I was a kid, I must have seen it like I don't even know how many times. 20 times.
I know. Harry Hamlin.
Yeah, exactly. But I recently, because I then saw the remake, which I didn't love as much, but I mean, it was okay. But then for some reason, it was on the TV or something, the original, and I was like, I'm not going to watch this. I saw this 20 times when I was however old.
And you can't turn it off.
You can't turn it off because
that damn owl makes you laugh. It's that stupid owl that makes you laugh.
I think, I mean, the owl is fine. I actually think the owl is quite, I mean, the owl was mocked in the remake, which I think is, I don't like the owl. But I was, you know, I really enjoyed it. I was like, you know, it's got a real menace. Even now, even though, you know, it's elements are dated for it, there's some real darkness there, which I thought was brilliant.
Well, and they're making a follow-up to it.
To the remake?
No, I think it's Rise of the Titans or something like that. So they're making an actual sequel to Clash of the Titans,
right.
And so that was going to be my question, is like, why didn't you base, you know, your first book? I mean, because with that being like your first love, it's kind of like the mythology and things like that. Do you have plans in the future to kind of incorporate that into your writing?
Well, it's an interesting question because it doesn't look like I've written anything to do with Clash of the Titans, but it's about going into other worlds. That's what I loved as a child. I loved fiction's ability to take you into a different world, and one of those, Clash of the Titans, was this mythological world, but it had nothing to do with where I was living in South London. It was, you know, it was like the disappearing into that world. And I really hope when you pick up, whether it's Jar 44, whichever of the books, you're going into another world. You know, it's like a voyage of discovery. You know, you curl up on your bed and you're suddenly in with the snow, and you're somewhere else. And I love that. The ability of fiction to teleport you into those worlds. I think it's a wonderful thing. It's totally magical because, you know, you are wherever you are. You're on a subway reading it, or you're in your lunch break reading it on a busy street, and you know, suddenly your mind is just somewhere else. You're just really engrossed in it, and that to me is that to me was the magic of fiction when I was a child. And I guess, you know, although it's not Clash of the Titans, hopefully the books do something similar.
Right. Yeah. I mean, because it was funny when I, you know, doing my research and I caught that and I go, you're like the only person I know that will say that they love the original Clash of the Titans, because a lot of people are like, oh, that movie's dorky. I can't believe you watched that. And then I'm like, that was a great movie. Are you kidding me? I mean, if you really sat and watched Clash of the Titans, come on. I mean, that's just like wonderful. But I understand. I thought the remake was really good. I like the new story, how they updated it and things like that. But, yeah, I mean, you can't take away the original, and I didn't like the way that they treated the owl in the new one when he kind of picked it up and looked at it and just threw it back down. But, you know what, I mean, that's Hollywood for you. I mean, they have to update it, so. But I do think it's going to be good that they're going to have a sequel to it, so, you know, I'm going to go watch that.
Yeah, I'll be watching it too, definitely.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Tom, I want to thank you so much for coming on. This has been very enjoyable. Agent Six is the book, and it's the last one here in your trilogy series. Can't wait to see what you got coming out, you know, in the future, probably around the same time next year is when I have to think that your next book would be out, and, you know, we'll be watching for it. So, again, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and, you know, have fun here on your book tour while you're in the United States.
Thanks a lot. I am having a lot of fun. It was great speaking to you.
Right. All right, Tom, enjoy yourself, and we will talk with you later. And thanks again.
No problem.
All right, bye-bye. So again, everybody, that was Tom Rob Smith, author of Agent Six, the third book in his trilogy series. It wraps it up, people. So you got to get it now. His website, tomrobsmith.com. Agent Six is the book. It starts off with Child 44, and then it starts off with the second speech, comes in here to Agent Six, or the secret speech, and then Agent Six. So make sure you go and, you know, pick up all three. Why not? You know, it's winter time. You guys are starting to get snow in the Midwest and the North, Northeast and everything else. You got nothing else to do. You're not going to go outside. It's cold. Go get books. So we were going to be right back here in about, in a couple minutes. I wanted to do a quick shout out, and I want to make sure that I get the right music for this one, because I read a story this morning. So you're going to hear me clicking some buttons here because I want to, like I said, I want to make sure I get the right music for this next little story. And I can't seem to find it. What is going on? Hold on, I think it's this one. No, it's not. It's this one. This is the one. So there was a story out this morning about a Baltimore elementary school. And this has nothing to do with books, but I just find this appalling. A Baltimore elementary school telling their children, if you don't wear purple or Baltimore Ravens gear to this pep rally, we're going to force you to sit in the library. Not only is that appalling on every level, I just can't believe that in today's day and age, especially in our society, with the education system as bad as it is, and with us keep throwing more money at it, this is my political rant, so excuse me, with us throwing more and more money at it all the time and whatnot, I just can't imagine that they would go so far as to be so stupid to email their parents and tell them if their children do not wear purple or Ravens gear, they're going to sit in the library. It just doesn't make any sense to me. So this is what I have to say to the people in Baltimore. And this song is for you. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. Again, that was my rant. That was my rave to that Baltimore school who told those elementary school kids, if you don't wear purple, go sit in the library. And what better way than to say, hey, teacher, leave them kids alone. So that was just me. So again, I want to thank Todd Rob Smith for being on the show here, but we're going to transition right into our next guest, and that is author Susan Wingate. She is also the host of a show here on Blog Talk called Dialogue Between the Lines that she co-hosts with Joshua Graham, another great artist and friend of ours. Susan's latest book here is Drowning, and it's great that she can join us because it won first prize at the 2011 Forward National Literature Award for drama. And so it's, you know, we just had, you know, the James Bond kind of guy, and now we're going on the total different shift of this genre, which is great to cover because it's such a wide spectrum of suspense, mystery, thriller, horror, as we're going on the other side here with Susan. So, Susan, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm great, John. Thank you for having me. This is quite an honor to be invited to Suspense Radio and your esteemed show. It's incredible. We listen to it often, and just we're always amazed at the wonderful guest you have.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, I appreciate the compliment. And you know what? Your book, Drowning, here, like I said, 2011, National Literature Award here, Forward National Literature Award for Drama. Give us a little bit about, Drowning and kind of, you know, this is a big award for you, and you got to still be on cloud nine after it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's nothing better than to see your book do well. You know, you always hope that people will get it, and you'll always hope that people will stay with it, you know, because my worst fear is that people will just put my work down and then I'll cry. But it's just, I'm still on cloud nine. There's no doubt about it. That was quite a lovely award, and it's led to other things too. So so anybody that's out there that's a writer that happens to be listening, because it would fall on deaf ears if not.
Right.
If you have work and you're, you know, it's whether it's published or unpublished, enter those contests because if you win, if you place, it's going to add to your credential. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. And just keep pounding away and getting it out there because it will lead to other things, other great stuff. So all good things have come from that. And Drowning was a real pleasure for me because it is heavily biographical, although it's extremely fictionalized. There are some biographical moments in there. The initial drowning scene was something that I did witness when I was about 8 years old.
And, you know, that's got to be, you know, when you just mentioned that 8 years old, that has to be extremely traumatizing for an 8-year-old, enough so to where, you know, I mean, it's just stuck with your mind. And, you know, how are you kind of able to cope with that kind of going forward and things like that? And then did it take you this long to be able to write it and find the right place that you were going to write something like that? Because you would think that that would be something that is very therapeutic to kind of write about, too.
Yeah, that's such a great question, John. Thank you for asking. It definitely was therapeutic, and it's funny because I started writing that story between novels. I was in between a couple of novels. Actually, Drowning was written. I finished Drowning, I believe it was in 2008, 2009, something like that. And I was between novels, so I was just doing exercises. So I went to Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott, who I absolutely love, and she had this writing exercise that said, think about a scene that you can fit into a 1-inch picture frame. And mm-hmm. And I thought of that because, I mean, it just really comes to the fore quickly. And I started writing about it, and, of course, that first scene came out, and then I wrapped it around what was going on in our life around that same time, around within at least 5 years of that time. What was interesting about that is that the actual drowning, her name was Cheryl, she's a distant cousin of ours, was basically pushed out of our minds. We didn't talk about it. We didn't think about it. We were young enough to where we could cover it, mm-hmm. to where, you know, how young minds can play games to stop thinking of certain things and get rid of things. And that's what I did. I think a lot of us did, because when I went back for the research on this, many of my cousins and aunts and uncles didn't remember specifics about it. We just kind of brushed it under a rug, which is really a tragedy for Cheryl because she was just this little girl, you know, and it's very sad. So, yeah, it was very therapeutic. I did get to talk to family members who I hadn't talked to in a long time about this because, again, we hadn't talked about it for years,
right.
Years. I mean, decades we're talking. So yeah, it brought up a lot of things that were happening in that same time period, which was, if you remember, that was like the early 60s, the middle 60s. And we were coming out of one phase, you know, being, you know, Betty Crocker and Father Knows Best phase into, you know, peace and love and no war type of situation where we were all being taught that everybody deserves freedoms, women and men alike, all ethnicities, all, you know, religious organizations need to have a voice and not one is better than the other. So it was kind of this going from a very patriarchal society to a very laissez-faire type of think in a very short amount of time. And in that time, lots was happening. And with everybody in the world, it was happening in our family as well. And so that's basically what this story delivers. It's a suspenseful tale about one woman's journey to her past.
And, you know, now, a lot of people just have to know, though, you know, you've written, you know, many other things. You know, you had the Bobby Diner series,
right.
A J.J. Adams mystery. So you've written a lot of things. But now your next book is going to be coming out, it's Treading Water, and it's book two of the Drowning books. And
mm-hmm.
So would you say that Drowning is the book? Because every author kind of sits there and says, you know, this is the book that I've been trying to get out, but the other ones were just kind of passing time. Would you say that about Drowning for you, that this is who Susan Wingate is? This is the book that you've been thinking about writing and you finally were able to get it out. And the other ones, you know, while they're, you know, very good in that retrospect, this is kind of your book. This is kind of the one that kind of, you know, not only has that big emotional pull, but this is kind of you.
Well, John, you're a writer. You know the answer to this question.
Yeah,
so
but
you
the
would
fans,
be,
you know, you got to ask them for the fans. You know, they don't know sometimes.
You would be a fabulous lawyer. You never ask the question you don't know the answer to. Of course, it's not my favorite, my one. I write because I am highly schizophrenic and I have many voices in my head, and so all the voices come out and in different genres and different genders, everything. So, I mean, although it was a fabulous story to be able to tell, I mean, I really enjoyed being in that story, I am writing other work that I just think is some of my favorite work. Of course, after I'm done with those and after those become published, I will be on, of course, and am on to other work. And those have become, you know, they are sitting out there as a glimmering of being my favorite book. So although I loved Drowning and I love telling the story of that family, it's just one story, and writers work to produce product and inventory just like a manufacturer. So I'm just a manufacturer. I'm just carving totem poles and, you know, and putting my wares out on the road for people to buy. So that's all I'm doing. And for the grace of God, I am allowed to, and I can. So, you know, it's all just what I do in a day, you know, write, and then clean cat boxes.
Well, I don't know if I actually knew the answer to the question, which is kind of what I did, because I know that some authors, once they kind of fall, they kind of fall into the trap, and I always kind of use it, it's the people that write the series, and there's a lot of authors that write series, and the series goes, and it goes, and it goes, and they seem to have just become comfortable and no longer interesting, you know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
How many times can you read the back of a book and say, like, I, you know, my favorite line is, this is the most dangerous killer they've ever faced. Yeah, well, that's what you said about the last book. So how many times can you keep using that line?
Well,
so
people must be getting really bad, you know, if you're meeting that many bad people.
I know, and it's like, you know what? When do you stop becoming an author? When did you stop becoming an author because you no longer are, and now you're just a commodity writing the same story over and changing the names of the villains or the whatnot, but it's still like the same kind of story. And that's when I feel that, you know, they need to change. And I know that it's like, yeah, but, you know, that's what they want and blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, sometimes you kind of, you know, write something different. Do something different. Not that you have to stop writing that character, but you know what? Do something else. You know, show them that you have a different trick up your sleeve, and you're just not a one, you know, trick pony, which is, it can happen to actors and actresses. You get stereotyped, and you always are in the same role. And it's like when you try to go outside that role, people are like, oh, I don't like that. Or it's like, wow, that was really neat. I never knew they could do that. So that's kind of why I kind of asked the question. I just was like wondering, you know, what kind of creativity that you're just going to keep coming from in the future. And that's what I like to hear, that this is one story, and I'm going to move on, and you just have no idea the voices that are talking in my head.
No, and you know what? You're absolutely right. People do get comfortable, and I'm so happy because I've been seeing some big name people, and I'm gonna mention one in particular. James Patterson does not let himself get bored, I don't believe, because you know, of course, you can. He did do a bulk of his mystery and suspense books, and you know, it was, you know, very similar and all that stuff, but. He is also doing children's fiction, and he's doing other things. He's doing fantasy. You know, he does everything. So it's really exciting to see somebody that is, you know, that large of a figure, that famous and very busy, obviously, but that he's doing things to keep his creativity going as well. And he doesn't, you know, when you think about it, he doesn't really need to. He could just sit back and yawn, you know, but he doesn't need to now. And so he's going forward and trying to spur his imagination and keep doing the things. He is a true author. You know, that's fun to watch, that even at his level, he's changing it up a bit. So, yeah, that's a good point, John.
Yeah, and, you know, and like I always say, you know, Janet Ivanovich is boring. She's boring now. Okay, you've written 17 books about the same character, and now Katherine Heigl's playing her in a movie. Fine, but she's boring, and you're no longer a writer. I feel that she's no longer a writer. She's just pulling out the same character, same thing, and it's, you know, and unfortunately, some people keep reading it, but she's one of the ones that is like, your character's done. You've written enough about it. I don't know how long you're going to keep going, and just literally, I have no problem in saying it. Why are you going to keep robbing the fans of their money because you're just not changing anything? And when I read the reviews on Amazon of the last couple books, a lot of people are like, I'm finished. I'm done. This is just ridiculous. I'm tired of the same stupid thing over and over. That comes to the point where now you've overstayed your welcome. And I don't want to see authors overstay their welcome. I don't like that. I think that's why I like Harry Potter so much, was because I knew there were 7 books, and I couldn't wait to get to the 7th.
Yeah.
I love the show 24 because I know there's 24 episodes in a season, and I know that there's a huge climax at the end, and that season's going to be done and over with, and when the next one starts, it's going to be something totally different. I like that. I like knowing there's an ending, not just this openness out there to say, oh, I'm just going to keep writing the same thing. Yeah, boring to me.
Right, but I need to play. I totally get what you're saying, and some of us do get bored. I definitely get bored. However, there are shows, and I'm gonna compare Janet Ivanovich to Law and Order, because I happen to absolutely love Law and Order, and I've been watching the
love
years
it too. I love them
1999 through 2011 over and over and over. I know every single Law and Order that's out there. I will watch them over and again, and I'll watch the new ones too. And it's the same stuff. I mean, I'm seeing the same stuff. I don't care. I just don't even care. And I think that she has a lot of people like that that just love the way she tells the story, and so they're going to buy her book. So in a sense, maybe she is going to lose some readers who are getting bored, who may be wanting to break out into other authors. So be it for them, great. But for the other people, you know, that's what she's serving a purpose as an author, and it's a good purpose. And we all need to, you know, remember that if she wasn't selling books, she wouldn't be out there, and she's selling books. So, so you know, good for her. She's doing what her readers want her to do, and maybe she's going to lose some, like I said, but you know, she's also going to pick some up. So I don't think, you know, she's doing what she's supposed to do.
Right, and I mean, I can, and I also see that, and I see that point too. I just always am along the lines of authors to me are artists,
mm-hmm.
and if Michelangelo did the same work and just did one in blue and one in yellow and one in red and one in purple, it's the exact same painting, it's just different colors, and therefore you're no longer an artist because you're doing the same thing over and over again. You're just changing the color to think that something's going to be different, and it's not. So
yeah.
That's why I hold authors to a very high standard, because you guys are artists. You are artists by words, and you have to put those pictures in my mind, which is why, and I tell everybody, I'm a very picky reader with suspense, thriller, mystery stuff. I give you 40 pages. If you haven't gotten me, you will not get me any further. You
that's
write
how I
suspense,
am.
Thriller stuff. Yeah,
40
you gotta
pages.
Get them.
Yep.
And that's
yep.
what's great about your stuff, because you intrigue me, and if you can get me past 40 pages, and I'm going to tell, and I tell people, only about 15% of the authors out there are able to get me in 15%.
Oh, thank you.
The first 40 pages, only about 15%. The other ones, they can have the greatest ending in the world. If you didn't get me at the beginning, I'm a beginning person. You've got to
yeah.
get me at the beginning. You've got to hook me in, so I want to keep going to see how it ends. But if your beginning is boring, I could care less what you did with the ending. I don't care if it's the most suspenseful, greatest twist thing ever. You took me on the most boringest car ride to get to the Taj Mahal, and I like that.
Yeah, no, and I agree. I totally agree. I'm the same way. It's actually, I know if I'm going to like the book or not within the first two pages, but I'll give it 40 pages.
Yeah.
After that,
because you understand the voice. You understand their voice. You can hear their
right.
voice.
Right, right. But I just love hearing that people, not like me, not like you, will read a book just because they started it and they feel like they have to finish it. I'm like, oh, my gosh, that's
yeah.
incredible. You're amazing. You know, they're the kind of readers that I want.
Right. I mean, I know people hear me in two sentences and realize they hate me. And that's fine, you know, but they just keep talking to me. So, but let me remind everybody first here that we're talking with author Susan Wingate, and the latest book is Drowning. You can find her out. A lot more information on SusanWingate.com. She's also the co-host of Dialogue Between the Lines with Joshua Graham. And that's kind of the next thing I want to do, because you're not only an author, but you're also, you know, you're kind of like me. You're almost like the news. What intrigued you and Joshua, another fabulous author, to go ahead and start a radio show to do this, to help out basically your competition? I mean, you're helping out other authors, which is your competition, to sell books, and you
yeah.
got the radio show. I've always been curious to know why you guys decided to do that and how much fun are you having?
Oh, we're having an incredible amount of fun. We started it because we saw that there were very few outlets for, unless they paid, for authors that
got
were just,
that right.
Yes, for authors that were just starting out to get their word out. And mm-hmm. so we started this. Joshua and I, by the way, I do want to do a shout out for Joshua Graham. His website is joshua-graham.com, and he is an incredible author. His latest book, Darkroom, is coming out in May, or at least April, May of 2012, and his book is up for pre-sale right now. There you go, Joshua.
Yeah. There
I'm
you
always
go,
thinking
Joshua.
About it. There's nothing wrong with Joshua Graham. He's an incredible,
no, he's
incredible
yeah.
author. But we did it because we saw this void of promotional availability for people just starting out or mid-listers. Of course, everybody wants, you know, big names on their shows, and so, you know, they were glutted, of course, and so we thought, no, we need to do something that opens it up for other authors, and that's basically why we started.
You know, and I just remembered something. You just mentioned how much you love Law & Order, and you love Law & Order.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know if you realize that next Saturday, one of our guests on the show here on Suspense Radio, I'll do a quick thing, is Neil Barr and Jonathan Green. Law & Order people.
Oh, my gosh. That's
so they're bad. Going to be on the show at 10:30 as
I'll
our guest
listening.
Next weekend. So, yes, and we'll get into some Law & Order, but, of course, they wrote a book together, and we're going to be talking about that. So, Yeah, I mean, you can't go wrong with that. So I had to make sure I got you on that one because, you know, it is great when you're on the radio like you are. And, of course, you see these authors, you know, because you're all colleagues, and you see them in events, and you be able to talk to them and this and that. But I think it's great to get them in more of a relaxed setting kind of like this where it's not the same conversations because if a lot of people go to these events, and you probably know, you see 10 little pockets of authors, and they're all talking. And it's every 10 conversations are the same one. My publisher's doing this. How come I'm right. not doing this? And it's the same conversation. So
yeah.
it's good to get them kind of on the radio and being able to talk and, you know, really being able to more comfortable, normal kind of setting. And it's great for these authors because there's so much time for marketing that they just don't know about. And everybody's trying to pull at the strings to get their piece of the 10% pie that they could possibly grab, that this is another reason why we started the magazine, too, because we wanted people to come to one place, to one show, to one area to find out about authors and things like that they normally would have to search hours for to try to find out about.
Oh, absolutely. And I have to say something about Law & Order as well. Last year, 2011. It is last year. It doesn't feel like
it
last
is.
Year.
It is last year.
Right, but I went to the BEA, the Book Expo America in New York, and because Drowning was coming out, and I wanted to, I was there for signing autographing event. That's what it's called, an autographing event at the Book
mm-hmm.
Expo, where people from the public, librarians, booksellers, all sorts of people come, and they get your books for free, and you sign them for them. Well. Everybody, all of a sudden, there's lines. There's like 15 lines of, and at the end of each line is someone like me, an author, signing books. So, and then they're with their publicist or their editor or whoever, and they're handing books to them to sign. And so that's how it was with me. And then all of a sudden, all of the lines except for one just went empty. Just emptied. And then this one was just trailing and trailing and trailing. I was like, what the heck is that? And I leaned back, and at the very same time I leaned back, Ice-T leaned back and looked me square in the eyes. And I looked at my editor and I went, oh, my God, it's Ice-T. And I mean, I squealed. I grabbed one of my books, and I ran over to him. He's
uh-huh.
probably thinking, who is this insane woman? But I didn't care. I ran over to him, and I said, I love your work. And I signed my book, and I said, here's my book. It's so great that you're on the show. You make it pop. And I ran back.
Right.
If I hadn't done it, if I hadn't acted at that very second when I thought, jump up and give him your book.
You probably would have never seen him again.
I wouldn't have, and this is why. Probably because, of course, you know, I would have gotten scared. I would have thought it through and went, oh, no, I better not. You know, I don't want to bother him, but I didn't care. And
right.
then within seconds after I sat back down in my little stool at the end of that empty, empty line, there were about 5 camera crew that came and surrounded him. And it was all over from there. There was no way you could have gotten near him.
Right.
But
it was kind of the same thing. It's kind of the same thing where we ran into Vincent D'Onofrio in Santa Monica. You know, I mean, it's kind of surreal. I mean, and he literally looks just like he does on the show. Let me tell you, he's a very imposing, scary-looking figure. I'm just
yeah.
telling you right now.
Is he,
yeah,
is he big?
He's very, yeah, he's tall. He's tall.
Is
he? I'm 6'4", and he's as tall as me.
Oh, my goodness.
So.
Well, Ice-T is just... I mean, he's big. He's a tall guy, too. He's not as tall
yeah.
as Vincent D'Onofrio, but he's pretty tall but big. I mean, because he is like a lifter, and so he's just, like, muscular, and his wife is muscular and gorgeous, and they're just, like, sitting there all beautiful, and I'm just happy I didn't trip.
Well, I'll tell you what, Susan. It's been great to have you on. We are out of time here, and I want to remind everybody, SusanWingate.com, pick up the book Drowning, listen to the show Dialogue Between the Lines. Everything is on your website, and you got some great guests coming up with Steve Barry. You got Douglas Preston, Lincoln Child coming up. You got
yep.
William Davis, the cigarette-smoking man from the X-Files coming
yep.
up on your show. So you got some names here, January, February, March. A lot of people, you know, definitely have to check out your show, read your book Drowning,
thank
go
you.
To your website and find out information. Joshua Graham also. And, hey, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, John. It was wonderful. Thanks a lot.
All right. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
So, again, everybody, we want to thank Tom Rob Smith for coming on the show to talk about his book, Agent 6. And his website is tomrobsmith.com. And we also want to thank here Susan Wingate for just joining us this morning to talk about her book, Drowning, and also her radio show, Dialogue Between the Lines, which you can be here on Blog Talk Radio. We are out until next weekend when we are going to have Neil Barnes, Jonathan Green, and Alan Jacobson is back with some exclusive announcements coming up with his book, Inmate 1577. You're going to want to stick around for that. So we're going to see you next Saturday right here, 10 o'clock Pacific time on Suspense Radio, where there's no other place you can find this kind of information. See you all next week. Bye-bye.